You're listening to the Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 13th of November 2018 on Monocle 24. The Monocle Daily, in association with UBS. Live from Midori House in London, this is the Monocle Daily. I'm Emma Nelson and a very warm welcome to today's programme. Coming up in the next hour, the EU and UK agree on the terms of a Brexit deal. But that's the easy part. The question now is, will it get past the British Parliament? Also coming up, CNN sues the president as its chief White House correspondent has his pass removed following a row at a press conference. What can happen when a broadcaster is placed on a collision course with the White House? Also ahead, a summit intended to establish Italy as a power broker in the future of Libya falls to pieces. We'll ask why almost nobody who really counted bothered to turn up. All that plus the Asian newspapers too. That's all ahead on the Monocle Daily, live from London, starting now. And a very warm welcome to Studio One. A deal, or rather the terms of a deal, have been agreed between the UK and Europe over Brexit. The news broke a few hours ago, and tonight key members of the British government have been summoned to Downing Street one by one for meetings with the Prime Minister. Well, Monocle's Paul Osborne joins me now. Paul, what's happened?
Rejoice. Rejoice,
ladies
and gentlemen.
Really? Do we?
After 2 years of negotiation, we've taken a vital step towards the point at which whatever deal this is will be rejected by the House of Commons and we'll be back to square one.
Now, this is getting ahead of ourselves. Let's establish exactly what's happened and why we should actually perhaps be rejoicing.
We should start by saying that everyone who is reacting to this, including me, including all the MPs and all the other commentators outside of people who are actually in the cabinet who have been in Downing Street tonight.
Yes.
And the people who've been in the talks, nobody else knows exactly what's in this deal. It's been reported via Irish television that the Irish government was saying a deal's been agreed. The British government hasn't said anything, but cabinet ministers have been going into Number 10 Downing Street this evening, one by one, to be shown the terms of the deal, to be shown what it is. Now, this is effectively the divorce deal. This is, after nearly 2 years of talks, this is agreement on how much Britain is going to pay to the EU in order to leave. We think about £39 billion. This is the deal, the outline deal on the rights of EU citizens in the UK, the rights of UK citizens in the EU. And somewhere within it is an explanation of how they've decided to get round the arguments over the Irish border.
It's about 400 pages long, this thing.
400 to 500 pages long to deal basically with those three things. There's nothing in here about the future trade relationship. There's nothing about the future defence relationship. There's nothing about the future diplomatic relationship. But there will be a political statement of, we think, 5 or 6 pages, which is probably far more important to read in full than the 500 pages of technical legalese, because that political statement will set out the future direction of how the two sides, the UK and the EU, envision those relationships, defence, security, diplomacy, future trade, all those kind of things. The outline will be in that political statement. The big 400 to 500 page sort of blockbuster that's going to arrive tomorrow is the technicalities. If it was a divorce deal, it's how they're splitting the bank account and who's getting the keys to the house. But it's not who gets to see the kids and who gets to go on holiday in the summer. All of the complicated stuff hasn't been done yet. This is just an attempt to have an outline agreement so that we get to the Brexit date at the end of March next year without a hard Brexit, without falling off a cliff edge. Because the transitional arrangement, which is the period of nearly 2 years after the Brexit date, when the UK basically sticks to the EU's rules, there's still freedom of movement, all of this, time to sort out all these other big issues. That can't happen unless this deal happens. This deal can't happen unless it's approved by the 27 EU member states, the European Parliament, and, crucially, the UK Parliament. And I haven't spoken to a single politician outside of the government who thinks this deal will pass Parliament.
To what degree is actually this able to be considered to be a deal then? I mean, a deal, many say, is you secure an arrangement as to how things are going to go ahead. But this, what you've described is exactly what is in those 400 pages, and who am I to disagree with you, Paul, just sounds like almost a statement of intention, and the assumption is that everybody will carry on chatting after March 2019.
Yes, but what's in this deal on those issues? So, for example, if the UK, as we think, has agreed that EU citizens already here will enjoy all of the same rights that they do now, that's in the deal. If it's passed by Parliament, it's legally enforceable. Similarly, if the UK, as we think, has agreed that in order to get round the issue of the Irish border, the whole of the United Kingdom would, as a backstop, and we need to keep saying the backstop is thusly called because it's if all else fails, that the UK, all of it, would go into a customs union with the EU. The bit that we didn't know is exactly how the UK would get out of that, because we thought the EU would be given a kind of a veto over it. That's going to be the pinch point. But those things in it are legally enforceable if you can get it through Parliament.
OK, now, you started off by saying this bit isn't going to happen. Tonight we are seeing people being summoned to Theresa May's lair in Downing Street. And the last time, when she summons people one by one, people either leave through the front door or the back door, and some emerge rosy-cheeked and others ashen-faced. When she does one of those headmistress calls you moments, things are said which people generally abide by. What's she telling those people in that room?
I think she's telling them that the choice is, much as she said publicly for the last sort of 3 or 4 months, there is no golden Brexit that's available. There is no sun will come out tomorrow, everything will be great Brexit, where the Brexiteers get everything they want. They get a clean break, but they still get to sell everything to the EU without any difficulties or tariffs, and everyone in Northern Ireland is happy and they all hold hands over the border and sing a song. That Brexit's not going to happen. The choices on offer are her version, with all of its compromises and all of the things. Nobody is 100% happy about this. The EU won't be 100% happy about it. The UK won't be. The Brexiteers won't be. The Remainers won't be. And, you know, a cynic would say that's what happens in a negotiation, and people were pointing this out 2.5 years ago during the referendum campaign. So I think she's saying to them, if you want to, the people who we say are on suicide watch, who may be about to resign tomorrow at the full cabinet meeting, she's saying to them, look, the choices are this deal that I have negotiated or no deal. And if there, what follows if there's no deal is not only does Britain plunge out of the EU at the end of March next year with absolutely no arrangements in place, which means you can't get on a train in London and get off in Paris as easily as you can, and vice versa. You can't load up a lorry with goods in Calais and easily get it over the border. It'll be stuck when it gets to Dover. There are companies today saying they're going to start stockpiling ingredients of their food. Companies talking about stockpiling medicines. All that stuff would happen. And the political reality of that would be, at the very least, Theresa May wouldn't be Prime Minister anymore. It's entirely possible that the government would fall and there'd have to be a general election, or maybe a second referendum, though it's very hard to see how that would happen. So I think what she's saying to members of the Conservative cabinet is, however unhappy you are, the alternative to my deal is chaos and probably the Conservative Party not in government anymore.
Nonetheless, there's a hefty chunk of Brexiteers who in the last 2 or 3 hours have said that whatever she is going to talk to them about today and tomorrow in the cabinet meeting at 2 o'clock at Downing Street, they will turn down. And Remainers and Brexiteers of all sides from the political parties have said, we will not go for this.
Yeah, the opposition have said that they think it's a bad deal. Again, they haven't read it, but they think it's a bad deal. No one can conceive a form of words that could satisfy the most extreme Brexiteers, the people like David Davis, Boris Johnson, Jacob Rees-Mogg at that end of the Conservative Party, and the most extreme Remainers, the people like Dominic Grieve, Anna Soubry, Justine Greening at the other side. Bear in mind, Theresa May does not have a majority in the House of Commons, so she needs all her MPs to vote for it, plus the 10 members of the Democratic Unionist Party with whom she relies on to get her stuff through Parliament. They are very unhappy because they think there's a back door in this arrangement that allows the rest of the UK, i.e. Great Britain, to leave this arrangement, start forming their own trade deals, and leave Northern Ireland in a customs union with that border, invisible border down the Irish Sea. They think that's going to be revealed within this document as a backup position. So there's no guarantee that they'll support her. She needs to find a form of words that can bring together people with wildly differing opinions who at the moment probably couldn't agree on what time it is or which is black and which is white. And say what you like about Theresa May as a weak leader, as a poor negotiator, as a terrible political campaigner, I can't think of a politician who would actually have been able to negotiate this, because people voted for promises that were, whether you agree with Remain or Leave, people voted for promises that were absolutely undeliverable. Theresa May's job was then to find a way of delivering absolutely undeliverable promises. Now, I'm not in here as, you know, member 001 of the Theresa May fan club, but I can't think of a single politician in the UK who would have been able to pull that off.
There's no mention of the unicorns that everybody was promised, as some are arguing. You talked a moment ago about how the European Union is not going to be happy with this. It is the nature of all compromises and negotiations for things to go that way. But tonight, an EU official who's in the middle of the negotiations reportedly just said, London has to say yes now. Given what you've just said, the European Union is much more single-minded in this, despite the fact that there are 27 member states. Are they going to stand firm on this deal?
There are still people in Westminster who think that when push comes to shove, the EU will blink. And it's true to say that a hard Brexit harms the other 27 countries, not as much as Britain, but to a significant degree. And it's not in their interest either for the EU to fall out of, for the UK to fall out of the EU without a deal. But they are also thinking about the bigger, wider project. They are concerned that other countries are drifting away from the EU axis. They're worried about Poland. They're worried about Italy. And the overriding opinion, they would rather that Britain hadn't left, but now that it's happening, they would rather get it over with and move on, build a decent relationship with the UK, but also deal with shoring up the rest of the EU. Because the whole reason why the EU was going to play hardball in these negotiations was that it had to show any other countries that were wavering that leaving the EU is worse than staying in.
Paul Osborne, thank you very much for joining us on Monocle 24. CNN has sued the Trump administration on behalf of their reporter Jim Acosta. Mr. Acosta had his White House pass removed last week after a tussle at a press conference. The White House spokesperson Sarah Sanders called Mr. Acosta's alleged behaviour unacceptable. He claimed his encounter with a press aide as a reason for taking his pass away. She subsequently tweeted an apparently doctored video of what happened between the two when the aide tried to grab the microphone. Well, to find out more, I'm joined by Amy Pope, who's associate fellow at the US and Americas programme at Chatham House, and a former Deputy Homeland Security Advisor to Barack Obama. Welcome back to Monocle 24, Amy. What are the grounds on which CNN is suing the White House?
They're bringing the grounds on the lawsuit on a number of different points. In the first instance, they're claiming that the White House is violating the First Amendment rights, the freedom of the press. And they're claiming that it is not appropriate for the president or anyone in his administration to bar a reporter from a press conference on the basis of his views or his hard questions. Likewise, they're alleging that there's a violation of due process, that they're making, the government is making this decision without any sort of hearing, and a violation of what is called the Administrative Procedures Act. Again, the claim is that the administration is acting based on political views and content or substance of questions instead of some other grounds which may be more acceptable, like security of the president.
Indeed. I mean, once you start saying the First Amendment and protection of journalists against arbitrary restrictions, it seems as if your path is slightly clearer to victory if you're the likes of CNN. However, it's an indication that if they're taking legal action, what, 5-6 days after this tussle at this press conference, it's an indication that negotiations are no longer working between the White House and CNN.
It's also an indication that it's not a straightforward case. I mean, there are some precedents for forcing the administration to allow reporters into press conferences. So that's, you know, this isn't coming out of nowhere. But there is a question. CNN has a number of different reporters who could cover the White House. And the specific question of can this one reporter be barred from coming to the White House press conferences is one that's still open. And I think CNN is taking a little bit of a legal gamble and putting it before the courts.
This is many people have been criticizing Donald Trump and the way that the White House have been treating journalists. CNN has been the target of Trump's anger, one could diplomatically describe it as, for a very, very long time. So many people have been criticizing Donald Trump, but something like this, CNN, you know, getting the support of many liberal supporters, campaigners for free speech, supporters of the press is one thing. But to engage in a legal battle, that would play beautifully into the hands of Donald Trump and his supporters, wouldn't it?
It would, but allowing Donald Trump to bar certain reporters or news stations from his press conference is basically a more significant outcome, right? If the president can say, I don't like you, you ask hard questions, I only want the easy questions coming my way, then he could, if he can do it here, he can do it again. And so I see that CNN is gambling on a larger principle. I mean, it is a gamble because, as I said, I'm not sure they'll win. But the principle behind it is that the president shouldn't be allowed to act this way. And if they don't push back on him, then they themselves are allowing a precedent to be set.
OK, let's move on to another bit of news that's breaking out of the United States in the last 10 or so hours. The Democrats have won another seat in the midterms, this in the Senate now, in Arizona, taking a seat from the GOP for the first time in a quarter of a century. Tell us more about what's happening there.
So this is an interesting race. There were two women who were running. The Democrat, her last name is Sinema. She had been running on an independent platform. She had pushed very, very hard against a Republican candidate for voting against healthcare for all people. The opponent here, McSally is her name, she had repeatedly voted to repeal healthcare. And that was one of the major issues in the campaign for the Democrats. Interestingly, what the race showed is that the hardline anti-immigrant message did not seem to resonate, particularly with swing voters. And that's important because Arizona is in the heart of the battle on immigration. They repeatedly will see unauthorized migrants crossing their borders. They've had to deal with the Central American migration and unaccompanied children on their borders. So if any place were to react really strongly on the migration issue, you would think it would be Arizona. These results suggest otherwise.
They suggest what? That people are looking for a more sensible and pragmatic way of doing business, given the fact that American politics is so violently polarized nowadays.
That's exactly right. And I suspect that they recognize that the promise of building a wall is not actually a real solution to real problems, for example, and that if the president is serious about fixing the issue of unauthorized migration, then he needs to be coming up with more sensible options.
Finally, a little bit more breaking news. There's the indication that Donald Trump's considering whether to fire his deputy national security advisor after she's apparently had a falling out with his wife, Melania. Given what your previous job was, deputy homeland security advisor to Barack Obama, what's going on, Amy?
This is highly unusual. First of all, I've never heard of a first lady weighing in on a question of whether or not someone on the national security staff should be hired or fired. What it does suggest, though, is that some of the tumult, the sort of political upheaval we've seen within the White House and including in the National Security Council staff continues. And that's not good news for the American people. It's not good news for our foreign partners. The National Security Council staff is meant to be apolitical. It's meant to put the interests of the United States first and foremost, to have these very public battles going on about who's in and who's out is a bad sign.
Well, given the fact that, imagine you're back in the White House, your former deputy homeland security advisor, what is it that could happen between you and, it would have been Michelle Obama, that could have caused for her wanting to have you kicked out? What could you have possibly done?
First of all, I can't imagine Michelle Obama ever weighing in on an issue like that. What's being reported is that this particular person was rude to people, including arguing with the First Lady, that she berated staff, that she was difficult, that she was not well-liked by several parties within the White House. But again, that kind of discussion about someone who's at a very senior level within the White House and that news being quite public at this point, is highly unusual and suggests that there's not a lot of discipline going on within the White House and that there's some more serious underlying personnel issues.
Amy Pope, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You're listening to the Monocle Daily with me, Emma Nelson. Up next, we find out why Italy's Libya conference has fallen flat. Stay tuned.
UBS has over 900 investment analysts from over 100 different countries.
Over 900 of the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance today.
No one has more. No one knows more.
To find out how we could help you,
contact us at ubs.com.
How do we make better cities? Places that work for people of all ages and backgrounds and provide the obvious essentials, from great transport to perfect places to work, as well as the softer elements that truly deliver quality of life, from urban swimming pools to rooftop clubs. Published by Gestalten, The Monocle Guide to Building Better Cities unpacks what makes a great city, whether you're looking for a new place to call home or need a little help fixing up your own. The latest in our series of beautiful large format books is available now. Buy yours at monocle.com/shop. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to the Monocle Daily live on Monocle 24. This is Emma Nelson. The time here in London is 22:21, and a little later on this hour, we'll be examining the cinematic legacy of Stan Lee. But first, with its domestic politics strained and its relationship with Brussels embattled, Italy had a chance this week to demonstrate that it was capable of doing good. It does have influence and it can show global leadership. A conference had been organised in Palermo in order to try to help Libya forge an organised and stable future. The trouble is, by mid-Monday, the list of people who are scheduled to attend was described very loosely as in flux. Well, I'm joined now by Silvia Poggioli, who's senior European correspondent at NPR. She's based in Rome, which is where she joined us on the line from now. Silvia, a very warm welcome back to Monocle 24. What was supposed to happen and what did happen?
Well, you know, expectations were very low at the outset, as you said. It wasn't very clear even who would attend. When the Italian government, this maverick coalition of two populist parties, when the prime minister announced this a few months ago, it was being blown up as something very, very big. They were even expecting Russian leader Vladimir Putin and the U.S. President Donald Trump to attend. Well, I can assure you that it was much, much more low key. And in fact, it looked even up until last night, it might even not happen. But in the end, the UN envoy for Libya, Ghassan Salameh, praised what he called the louder sound of unity among the regional players and a higher sense of conviviality between Libyan rivals. So basically, for the first time in 5 months, the two rival leaders, the UN-backed Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj and the General Khalifa Haftar, who commands the eastern part of Libya, they met, they shook hands. They didn't take part, all of them, the Haftar didn't take part of all the meetings, but it was basically that they agreed to meet again in another UN-sponsored meeting at the beginning of next year, which should plan for elections later in the year in Libya.
Why is Italy so keen on taking charge when it comes to the future of Libya's politics?
Well, first of all, there's a geographical proximity. Italy is the former colonial ruler. But more importantly, it has basically been Libya has been in a state of chaos and lawlessness since 2011, when the NATO-led operation ousted the longtime strongman Muammar Gaddafi. The country's been in chaos. It's full of Islamic militants and, of course, human traffickers. And Italy has been the object, until at least a few months ago, of the arrival of tens and tens of thousands of migrants who come not from sub-Saharan Africa, but who arrive in Libya and who make the crossing by boat through traffickers. So Italy has had a long interest in trying to restore a sense of lawlessness and basically to curb the migrant crisis. And of course, Italy also has big oil interests in Libya, and there's a lot of rivalry with France. In fact, there's been on who will take the lead in sort of creating the new Libya.
So with this issue to surrounding this conference in Palermo, where people didn't turn up or they turned up late, or in the best we got out of everything was a handshake, what has happened to Italy's credibility now when it comes to its role on the world stage?
Well, you know, certainly it has bigger problems right now. It has the problem of its budget, which is very much criticized, high spending budget, which is close to a showdown with the European Union because it's breaking the rules on deficit spending. So this is a new government. It's only been in power for 6 months. It's very inexperienced, at least certainly one of the parties, the Five Star Movement, that's part of the coalition, is very inexperienced both in domestic politics and certainly in foreign policy. I think it'll be a while before we see Italy again take a big lead or any kind of important position in foreign policy. It's got huge problems at home. It has to now deal with its confrontation with the European Union over the new budget.
So where does this lead Libya now? You said that various political high-powered players were shaking hands at this conference, but they have elections to organise, peace to broker, a country to build.
Absolutely. And as I said, perhaps now they will have this UN organized sponsored conference in Libya, probably in January, if all goes well. And that is the conference that should lay the groundwork for the elections. The problem is also that Europe has to get its act together on what sides they're, on helping the country get together. Because, again, Italy is very much backing the UN-sponsored the prime minister in Tripoli. France is more on the side of the Eastern leader general, and there's a whole lot of rivalries also between countries in the region, and the problem is also who's backed by also Islamist groups, and France, for instance, and Egypt are very much opposed to the Tripoli-based prime minister because he also has alliances with some Islamist groups. Italy's more on that side, so there's a lot of confusion and a lot to be resolved before anything gets better in Libya soon.
On the line from Rome, Silvia Poggioli, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24. You were The Daily with me, Emma Nelson, and in a moment we head to Calgary as the city holds a referendum on competing to host the Winter Olympics. But first, with the time 23:28 in Zurich, 22:28 here in London, a summary of the latest world news headlines. Britain and the European Union have agreed a draft Brexit deal after more than a year of talks. The agreement puts even more pressure on the Prime Minister Theresa May, who now must get the deal approved, first by her divided Conservative cabinet and then by Parliament. Mrs. May will meet cabinet ministers at 10 Downing Street on Wednesday afternoon to review the deal. Rescue teams in California have been searching the town of Paradise, expecting to find more victims of the wildfire. The Camp Fire blaze is the deadliest in California's history, with 42 people now confirmed dead and more than 200 people still missing. And the US President Donald Trump is considering whether to remove his deputy national security advisor, who's reportedly clashed with his wife Melania. The First Lady has told Mr. Trump she's not happy with how she's being treated by Mira Ricardel. The former Boeing executive previously worked on the Trump campaign. A statement for the First Lady's office says Ricardel no longer deserves the honour of serving in the White House. You're listening to the Monocle Daily. Welcome back to Studio One. If you've just joined us, you're with the Monocle Daily. This is Emma Nelson. And a little later, we'll have a summary of the Asian newspaper headlines. But first, throwing your hat into the ring to host an Olympics is a big deal. Calgary should know. 30 years ago, it played host to the Winter Olympics and enjoyed world fame as a result. Well, three decades on, and some now argue that it's a tougher job. More risks, less rewards. So why would Calgary even think about having another go? Well, it is, and it's currently holding a referendum on the plans. Jeremy Clazes is Monocle's Calgary correspondent, and he joins me on the line now. So the referendum is taking place, what, now, Jeremy? What's happening?
As we speak, yes, and it's shaped up to be quite interesting, in fact. At first, the sentiment around town was that, you know, this was going to be voted down. There was quite strong opposition to the idea of the Olympics, even though there is strong nostalgia in Calgary for the 1988 games that were here. But yeah, in the last couple weeks, there's been a real kind of juggernaut of bid boosters who have been promoting the yes side of the bid, and they've been all over on social media, and it's been kind of wall-to-wall advertising everywhere you go, talking about the benefits of this bid to Calgary. And so it should be very interesting. Nobody knows which way it's going to go tonight.
What are the arguments for not holding it?
Yeah, I mean, the arguments are familiar to anybody who's, you know, followed any of this stuff at all. Basically, why would you want to get, why would you want to partner with the IOC? In the past, when Calgary has bid on Olympic Games, you know, there's been contests within Canada. Calgary's been competing with different cities for the Canadian bid. On this one, you know, Calgary stands alone, and there's only two other contestants in the running for 2026. And so there's apprehension about cost overruns. There's apprehension about the IOC. Now, bid boosters say that this will be a lean and mean games that'll be, you know, only involve construction of two new venues. And that's how they've been selling it. You know, this won't be, we won't have all these capital cost overruns. But that's not usually how these things go. So it'll be interesting.
It will. I mean, there are other issues, that broader issues that if you live and work in Calgary, you'll be aware of. The fact is that Calgary has arguably had a bit of a crisis of confidence in the last few years. It, you know, it had a wonderful time when it first had the Winter Olympics and made its name globally as a wonderful place to go skiing if you want to. But there are other industries in Calgary which have been having slightly less happy times, aren't there?
Absolutely. And in particular, the energy industry has been hit hard by the economic downturn. And so part of what's behind this bid is it's being presented as an opportunity to kind of galvanize the city and give it a little bit of a boost because things have been in a slump. And so, yeah, there's that push that, you know, a games could be the catalyst for basically building Calgary's next chapter around this Olympic bid. The skeptics of that would argue, you know, we can do that without getting a games. But it's an interesting conversation. Yeah.
Indeed, some people say, look, the Olympics means that you can get stuff done. You can increase funding. You can re-galvanize areas which need a bit of love. Are the Olympics a very good and efficient way of doing this? Or could Calgary actually get its act together by itself?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because there's kind of two arguments being made. On one hand, you know, people behind the bid are saying this will be a lean and mean games. There's not going to be all these projects. But even people, you know, there's a city councillor who says if we do get the bid, then we can look at, you know, LRT to the airport, transit to the airport. We can look at a new NHL arena. We can look at all these new projects which we could add to this bid. And so, I don't know. It's been actually quite divisive in town, surprisingly divisive, this debate, more than you would expect, because people who are in support of the bid see it as really, you know, how could you say no to it? And people who are opposed to it, I think kind of resent, you know, being oversold on the economic benefits of the games and all that sort of thing. So it's been quite divisive.
Who's been leading the argument or who's been leading the division? You have a new mayor. You have a very, very vocal local press as well.
Yeah, and it's been interesting. The mayor's role has been quite unconventional in this because usually you have the mayor or the governor or your state leaders or whoever come out and say, we want the Olympics, we're going to pursue it. And then they kind of champion it and drive it. Whereas in Calgary, Mayor Nahed Nenshi has kind of, everybody knows he's an Olympics freak. He loves the Olympics, but he's kind of opted to sit back and play it more cautiously. And meanwhile, a bunch of people who have worked on his campaigns are driving the Yes campaign in town. And only recently, within the last couple of weeks, has Mayor Nenshi come out and said, vote yes, this is why this is a good reason for Calgary, make this happen. So it's been interesting. It's been quite messy in a lot of ways.
The vote is announced in what, the next few hours, Jeremy? Who's going to win?
You know, if you would have asked me that question 2 or 3 weeks ago, I would have said the no side would win. But right now, I ask that same question of others and they say, I don't know. And I'm in the same position. I wouldn't bet on this one.
Jeremy Clausus, Monocle's Calgary correspondent, thank you very much indeed for joining us on the Monocle Daily. Let's hear a little treat from this week's episode of The Entrepreneurs. Fokker de Jong is the founder and CEO of the menswear label Suit Supply. It earlier this year opened its 100th store. It was launched in 2000 and in the Netherlands as a direct-to-consumer brand. Suit Supply has succeeded in finding a lovely balance between online and bricks and mortar. Well, Fokker de Jong sat down with Daniel Bache and talked to him about growth, his role in the company, and plans to move into women's wear. Is a snippet of the conversation.
I was always inspired by, first of all, entrepreneurship. And I liked aesthetical stuff, right? Beautiful stuff like architecture, design. But I also like to make money, right? Or money, at least have the freedom to do what you like. I think that's the main driver for a lot of entrepreneurs. It's not so much being or getting a lot of money or being rich. It's just having the freedom to do what you want. I was inspired by that from a young age. I remember I was actually recalling that with my parents a few weeks ago, that when I was 8 or 9, I wanted to sort of start my own company. And I was in school and they did sort of for a charity, collected old paper, right? And people always took the old paper and put it in a big container. And to buy, I don't know, a VCR or something for the school. I was like, oh, wow, you can get money for... So I built a little cart behind my bicycle, and I think I went down, up and down, like 1,000 times before I had a container filled with old paper that I sold. And I don't know, a few $100, maybe $1,000, got me my first amplifier, and then I got a drive-in show. And that was when I was 8. I think, and I started doing that, all that kind of stuff. I had all these kind of little businesses, pinball machines. When I was 15 or 16, I was, when the Iron Curtain fell and I was in high school, we suddenly had a business in Czechoslovakia where we imported milk powder and sold it to Saudi Arabia. And we were like hugely successful for 6 months until obviously they found out, because we were just sending out faxes, that we were just a bunch of guys with a fax machine, and we went bust. So that's the moment I decided to go to college, which was interesting on one hand, but it also took me a lot of time, I guess. And I was a little hard to concentrate in college. But what it did, because I needed a job sort of to get me through college and make some money. And so at some point, I ran into a guy that worked with some factory in Italy, and that got me connected to suiting. And they made a beautiful product, right? And I always liked clothing and I liked the design, like I said. And so I set up a little business out of the trunk of my car, basically to sell suits to my fellow students that needed their first work suit, or on Friday afternoons organizing sort of Tupperware parties in offices. Where the funny thing was, you went into the office and you said to the secretary, gee, these guys in your office all like they could need a suit upgrade. And obviously they always agreed. And I said, well, we can do that if you can organize something on Friday afternoon. So I had these Tupperware parties and it got me to college, but it also gave me an insight how sort of old fashioned and inefficient that whole luxury tailoring industry was working at the time. It was very beautiful little factories in Italy. that made a nice product, but then went to trade shows, had agents, and that sold these products to all the, let's say, the independent retail stores. So a lot of people in between before the product actually ended up to the consumer with a lot of inefficiencies. We all know this, how this works, a typical direct-to-consumer. But at that time, it was 2000, and direct-to-consumer obviously was done by the Zaras and the H&M of the world for the middle, let's say, quality segment, but not so much for the luxury. Mm. And it was also when online came up. So we decided to do, and basically, just take one step back, I almost finished college. I started to work for Procter & Gamble because that was something everybody was at that time, like, you have to work for a big corporate. I lasted a week. And I was like, I mean, there's still the thing that you want as an entrepreneur, and I think from young of age, to have your own freedom was sort of what instilled me to quit that and start out to say, okay, I have this connection to the industry. I see what we can do there, how to disrupt it. And I also like the product and what I can do with it. So we just started a direct-to-consumer online business in suiting, which went pretty okay. But then we thought, you know what, it was a little bit ahead of the curve, right? At that time, everybody in online thought that if you buy something online, it should be cheaper than if you buy something in the store. That was the perception at the time. And so we decided to open a store next to it where you can sort of pick up your stuff, have a tailor in there. And we opened it between next to the highway, almost next to a gas station, between the two busiest cities in Holland, between Amsterdam and Rotterdam. And everybody thought we were completely out of our minds.
And that was Fokker de Jong, who's the founder and CEO of the menswear label Suit Supply, who's talking to Monocle's Daniel Bache. You can hear the full interview, which premieres tomorrow at 1900 London time. This is the Monocle Daily. In a moment, Carlo Bonura joins me to go through the evening papers in Asia. Stay with us.
UBS is a global financial services firm with over 150 years of heritage, built on the unique dedication of our people. We bring fresh thinking and perspective to our work, and we know that it takes a marriage of intelligence and heart to create lasting value for our clients. It's about having the right ideas, of course, but also about having one of the most accomplished systems and an unrivaled network of global experts. That's why at UBS, we pride ourselves on thinking smarter to make a real difference. Tune in weekly to The Bulletin with UBS for all the latest insights and opinions from UBS and experts from around the world.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the program as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the program that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
Is 6:43 a.m. in Beijing, 22:43 here in London. Let's have a look at the Asian front pages now. And I'm delighted to say Carlo Bonura, Senior Teaching Fellow in Southeast Asian Politics at SOAS here in London, joins me in the studio to... You've gone to all the papers for us, haven't you? Every yep. single Asian paper. What a job. Carlo, what have you found?
Well, there's a lot of discussion of the Asian or the ASEAN Summit, which is the Association for Southeast Asian Nations Summit. Usually not a very exciting thing. The Singaporean Prime Minister gave a speech. Singapore is the chair this year, gave a speech in support of multilateralism. What's really fascinating about Southeast Asia and ASEAN as an organization is that they there's a lot of enthusiasm for multilateralism in a globe or a world where we have Trump, Brexit, reticence in the European Union for free trade deals. And so Southeast Asia is slightly different insofar as political elites see multilateralism as a way forward, even though ASEAN itself as a international or regional organization is not particularly effective, except in terms of facilitating trade.
So how are they pushing multilateralism forward? As you say, everybody else is putting walls up.
Well, there's a number of different ways. There's a large appetite for regional free trade deals, the most important which is the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP. This is a free trade deal that is organized or oriented, founded by Southeast Asian countries, but oriented toward China, as opposed to the United States, which pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership 2 years ago, or last year, a year and a half ago now, under the Trump administration. And so RCEP's a very good example of regional multilateralism.
It's an interesting idea, isn't it, that we have speakers at the conference who are saying, actually, now is the time for ASEAN to lead the world in a world order that many people are questioning whether it still exists. But actually, if they do pull together, they can see a real opportunity.
Yeah, I think this is a very large free trade agreement in terms of RCEP. What is fascinating is that you have a lot of economic nationalism in other parts of the world, in India, in the EU, Britain, certainly in the Trump administration. And the rhetoric there with regard to multilateralism has not changed one bit. The interesting thing that in terms of a commentary in the Jakarta Post is that during this ASEAN meeting, the one person who is absent from the meeting, of course, is Donald Trump. And this commentary, which is different from the Straits Times piece on multilateralism, argued that there was a whole list of reasons why in fact, maybe ASEAN leaders were better off with Trump missing, including all of these awkward bits that Trump would be scared of, namely discussion of multilateralism. It listed handshakes, which I thought was hilarious, that he can't get the cross-armed handshake, right? But more seriously, meeting Li Keqiang, the Chinese leader, that would be awkward. And then discussion of RCEP in the midst of the U.S. pulling out of TPP.
It's funny how many organizations are beginning to think, well, if we just ignore him, maybe he'll go away.
Yeah.
Let's move to the Bangkok Post and issues about small to medium enterprises.
Right. So the Thai banking sector has been facing a problem with non-performing loans over the last, let's say, 3 years. The rates for non-performing loans in certain sectors have done fairly well over the last 6 months, but actually small and medium enterprises, these rates are fairly high, with the construction industry being around 7%. Now, to put this into larger historical perspective, these rates are not particularly high. If we think about the financial crisis in the end of the 1990s, the rates were closer to 50%. So this is not a crisis in the making. However, for the Thai government, the military government, they have been struggling to produce good economic performances and growth. They finally have good export numbers. And so this non-performing loan issue simply won't go away for them.
So what is the way out of this?
Well, part of the, in terms of avoiding a crisis, the Thai banking system has far more liquidity and far better legal infrastructure and banking infrastructure to deal with this. I think the Thai government thought that once they were able to stimulate exports, that they would be able to grow their way out of this problem. But for small and medium enterprises, as the article argues, this hasn't, they use the language of trickle down, that the export growth simply hasn't affected this type of the sector.
Now let's move on to a figure who many of us thought had gone away. She dominated the headlines, Imelda Marcos, but she has been convicted for corruption. She's 89 years old.
Yeah.
The shoes are still obviously something to be talked about. But what people are talking about now is whether she's going to be handcuffed when she's arrested. What is this all about?
Well, first of all, in the Philippines, she has not gone away. She's part of she's the head of a dynasty, the matriarch in a dynasty, which is politically still very successful. Her daughter is going to run for Senate next year, likely win that race. She herself may take over as governor after her daughter leaves. She's a representative of Congress. There's a lot of confusion over what has happened after her conviction on graft, in which she's accused of squirreling away some part of her $10 to $50 billion in looted assets overseas in Swiss bank accounts. But the question here was, the confusion is over whether or not an arrest warrant has actually been issued. If not, why? And the head of the police made things worse by simply saying that we wouldn't handcuff her, and people interpreting that as they wouldn't actually arrest her.
So I was about to say, the fact that she might not be arrested, what does this suggest about what might happen to her and her legal situation?
Well, I think right now the question, all of this hopefully will be resolved on November 16th, when a motion is going to be ruled on by the court to as to whether or not to defer her arrest. But if the arrest deferral really does take place, it is very likely that she will. I don't know if we can predict whether or not she'll do any jail time, but it's possible that down the road there might be a pardon from Duterte in the works.
Is that the possibility?
I think so. Now,
and
at this point,
how will that go down?
Well, they are on the same sides of the political spectrum. I think Marcos right now, Ferdinand Marcos, the figure of Ferdinand Marcos is very popular. Many people see a strong connection politically and ideologically between Duterte and Marcos. So this is not something that would trouble the Duterte administration.
Okay, finally, let's have a quick look about the Saudi envoy to Indonesia. What is happening here?
Okay, so the head of the Islamic Defenders Front has been which was instrumental in organizing the massive protests against the former governor of Jakarta a year and a half ago. He has been in self-exile for I think about a year. And he got in trouble with the Saudi authorities because he had the Tawhid flag, or the black flag that is associated with the Islamic State, somewhere in his apartment. It's hard to figure out from this story whether or not this is a small amount of pressure from the Indonesian government through the Saudis to try to make Rizik's life in Saudi Arabia slightly more difficult, or if this is a misunderstanding, or if he anticipated that he would simply be able to carry on in Saudi Arabia like he does in Indonesia. He has a huge amount of leeway in Indonesia, with the exception of the fact that he was the subject of a pornography case in which he was accused of circulating.
Hang on a minute. We're dealing with someone. So on the one side, he's flying a flag which purportedly supports Islamic terrorism.
Yeah.
At the opposite end, he's involved, or there are claims that he's involved in pornography.
Well, he was
an interesting person.
And of course, the contradictions and ironies were not lost on people at the time when he was accused of circulating the sex tape. That case has been dropped now.
Hang on, there was a sex tape circulated.
Sex video. It was a video that was taken on a mobile phone. Right, that's how he breached the pornography law. He was accused of circulating this this video. Right,
okay. Yeah. Goodness.
That's been dropped, but he's still in exile.
Oh, well, that's all right then. I mean, this is someone who I think many people diplomatically would wish would just go away, but that's just not going to happen, is it?
He's not going to go away. The case has been dropped against him. So the Indonesian government has kind of allowed for space for him to return, but it's been his choice not to.
And what does this do for the relationship between Jakarta and Riyadh?
I think this is the question. If this is a sign that the Indonesians are trying to get the Saudis to pressure him to leave the country, then the relationship is fairly strong because they're both on the same page. If Rizik is going to start causing trouble in Saudi Arabia, and perhaps that's what the envoy was referring to when he said that he's not a threat to our country, as a veiled way of saying, in fact, he is a kind of threat to our country, then this could cause slight tensions between the relationship between the two countries.
Carlo Venura, senior teaching fellow in Southeast Asian politics at SOAS. Thank you very much for joining us on Monocle 24. Now, there are a few people on this earth who, if not aware of the name Stan Lee, will certainly be aware of his work. He was a creator of the likes of Spider-Man, the Hulk, Iron Man, Doctor Strange, the list could go on and on. Well, Stan Lee died yesterday, aged 95, but as well as capturing the imaginations of billions of children, how far did his influence stretch much further in terms of what it did for cinema? Well, I'm joined by Karen Krasanovich, Monocle 24 regular and film expert like no other. Karen,
like
welcome
no other.
Back to Monocle 24. So, Stan Lee, his works, you could arguably say that there's a poster on pretty much everyone's wall between the age of about 5, 12, and then there's a bit of a gap and it possibly returns again when you're in your early 20s.
He appealed to, well, I mean, he was 95 and he was very, very prolific. And at 17, he actually was left with a comic book to run because the art director and editor had left. So he sort of started out early and was incredibly creative between the sort of 1961 and 1971. He created all of these amazing characters, like Spider-Man, the Hulk. He calls Spider-Man his Mickey Mouse. X-Men, Avengers, Fantastic Four, Black Panther, Ant-Man, Iron Man, Thor, Doctor Strange. I could keep going. Now, these are fairy tales for adults because he realized that kids love the fairy tales and love that sort of, you know, the daring do and the flawed characters, but couldn't be sitting around reading, you know, Brothers Grimm for the rest of their life. So he realized that people still enjoyed these stories and he braved it out and kicked a few doors down.
Huge identification with that of the outsider in every single one of these characters. So absolutely. Is that what it was that took him so long to break into mainstream movies? Because he's creating a lot of the Marvel Universe characters that you're talking about then. In what decade? But it's what, the 50s, 60s? But then it's the late 60s, early 70s before anybody decides to actually make a proper film out of this.
Well, nobody took graphic novels or cartoons seriously or whatever you want to call those. And don't forget, he was coming up with ideas, but he worked with many, many talented writers, and a lot of them later on sort of accused him of stealing the limelight from them, and he didn't give enough credit, and that goes back and forth. But he was terrible at dialogue. It was always very bombastic and always in sort of third person. But he had wonderful ideas, and the film industry in the 70s is very different than how it is now. Nobody was taking these kind of these sort of films seriously, and he was selling off a lot of internet intellectual property. And if you look at the 70s and 80s sort of films, they're pretty bad. Some of the 1990s, and the 1990s Captain America, it's really a bit of a stinker. So what happened? In 2000, the X-Men came and broke a lot of barriers. Now, I'm looking at historically why that happened. That's way before you know, the franchise was bought up. So it was just a matter of us wanting something fresh and innocent to see.
Fresh and innocent, and arguably forming a template now for the mainstream blockbuster. I mean, how many of the films that we see released this year, last year, the year before, are based on the Marvel model?
Well, six of the
Or indeed the characters are still going.
Yeah, well, six of the top 10 at the US box office this year feature superheroes, and three of those sort of borrow from that kind of zeitgeist. But, I mean, arguably, I suppose you could say Steven Spielberg invented the, you know, Jaws, invented the blockbuster. But Stan Lee really made it acceptable for us to enjoy the universe, in fact, the Marvel universe, that it's okay to watch flawed characters who have superpowers, because don't forget, Iron Man doesn't actually have a heart. I mean, they're not perfect people. They're not like Superman and Batman, who are nicey-nicey and perfect.
What's a heart between you and me? Karen Krasanovich, thank you very much indeed for joining us on Monocle 24 to talk about the legacy of Stan Lee. That's all we have time for today's edition of the Monocle Daily. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. The show was produced by Daniel Bache and Ben Ryland. Thanks to them both. The researchers are Daphne Karnesis and Martha Libri. And thanks to our studio manager, Kenya Scarlett. The Globalist kicks off the day in Europe in 8 hours' time. Your host with us is Georgina Godwin. The Monocle Daily returns at the same time tomorrow, 2200 London time. I hope you can join me for that if you can. But for now, from me, Emma Nelson, goodbye. Thank you very much for listening.